quite different path. And disobedience of those laws is not sinful, but disgraceful. Here is the great Olympian Apollo, who may be able to represent the principle represented there in the Acropolis, the principle of illuminated life. But in the Greek world, we have another god. We have Dionysos. And Dionysos represents exactly the dynamics of that center which I was talking. We can put Apollo in the field of life, in the field of consciousness, as representing the comely majesty of noble human life as interpreted in the Greek tradition. Dionysos, on the other hand, is something that smashes things. Now, the greatest, almost vivid, at any rate, discussion of the contrast and interaction in Greek life of Apollo and Dionysos that I know is Friedrich Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy. It's a magnificent work. It was composed when he was in his early 20s, just about 102 years ago. Here one sees Apollo representing the principle of form, Dionysus representing the period, the principle of flow, the flow of time, which brings forth forms and shatters them, brings forth forms and shatters them. The interaction of those principles is life. If the form becomes too strict, then the flow is inhibited and piles up and becomes dangerous. Now, the law that is given of a god that can't be changed is a form that does not. This is the Greek principle. In the word demon, we have both concepts from the classical point of view, and as Goethe used the word, the demon is the dynamics of your life. But think how it sounds from the standpoint of our biblical heritage. It means a devil, absolute evil. From the Greek point of view, there is no such thing as absolute evil. Nietzsche points out that drunkenness, the shattering of forms, is the first outright experience of the Dionysian principle. That wonderful feeling that some of you may share with me when a tray full of dishes fall. Here is the god riding on the tiger, riding on the lion, the roaring power of life that shatters form. Power to ride on that is the power of the Dionysian god. It is the tearing apart of the animal, of the form. Now, as you know, in the classical world, in the 7th, 6th, and early 5th centuries, there was a kind of fashion or vogue or frenzy of Dionysian orgies, in which particularly the women participated, Amines and so forth, around the god. And these were, to the Apollonian Greeks, outrageous affairs. Here I have what I think is a rather charming scene, the god seducing a young lady. Obviously, a jeune fille de famille there, well brought up and all. And the god says, "Come, darling," and he has the cup of the wine there. He says, "You'll find some very interesting girls here. They know how to do things you haven't heard about yet." And here's one of them with snakes in her hair and a leopard about to be torn apart. What is it about the snake? Why do we find the serpent in all the great mythologies of the world usually a positively affirmed animal? Only in our tradition is the serpent negative. The serpent has the power to shed its skin and be born again. The serpent represents the power of life to throw off death. It is associated, therefore, with the Dionysian frenzy, which throws off forms to bring forth new forms, sheds the skin, as the moon sheds its shadow to be born again. So the serpent and the moon are, respectively, the earthly and celestial signs of the power of life in the field of time to throw off death and be born again. The feline animal, the leopard, the lion, has another meaning. When the moon is at its full on the 13th night, it faces the sun across the world. You see the sun setting, you see the moon rising, and if you're out on the plains or out on the ocean, you will notice they are the same size, they are the same brilliance, and you won't know whether you're looking east or west. From that moment on, the moon dies into the sun and is born of the sun. In this tradition, the sun is feminine. The sun is the mother of the moon, and the moon is masculine. You get this in German. Der Mond, masculine moon, die Sonne, feminine sun. In contrast to that, in the later strongly patriarchal system, where the warrior hero associates himself with the unmitigated light of the sun, dispelling shadows, you have a masculine sun and a feminine moon. Latin, in French, feminine moon. Le soleil, le sun, that masculine sun. This is why France and Germany can never get out. And I really mean it. There's a totally different spirit of life when you realize life in the way of a solar and when you realize it in the way of a lunar heroism. Anyhow, here's one of these Minas. And here is her younger sister. This picture always makes me think of my students at Sarah Lawrence College after their first sociology class. Nietzsche speaks about epileptics of the concept. People who have received an idea that they can't handle and are born with. The student has heard that her father's business is, you know, built on blood and bones and exploitation. She goes home then to the Thanksgiving dinner. It's a lovely party. And fortunately, she's going to be in an institution for the next 4 years, but that doesn't always suffice. Anyhow, here we have her in the Greek tradition in the 5th century B.C. That is to say, associated with this Dionysian dynamism is something that is closely linked to the feminine principle in contrast to the male. Apollo is definitely on the male side. Dionysos is associated with the Minas. And when we go back 2,000 years to 2500 or 2000 BC, we come to the source of this. This is one of those glorious Cretan priestesses in the form of the goddess. And you'll notice the animals, the serpent, which sheds its skin to be born again, and the feline animal, the panther or lion, which represents the solar principle, which never dies. The light of the sun never dies. We are in the dark when the sun departs, but not the sun. Whereas the moon carries its death within it. These are the two contrasting images of eternal life. The sun, the lion, which is the sun's animal, eternal life, transcendent of engagement in time and space. The moon, dying and born again, eternal life, engaged in the field of time and space. Here is a beautiful gold seal ring from Crete from the same period, about 2000 to 1500 BC. And you'll notice down the note there. We have the plant, as I said, you should see it. And we have where the female dominates in the religious cult as priestess or Minet. We have the dance. We have a spontaneous expression of the experience of the joy and rapture of life. Where the feminine is dominant in the religions, the accent tends to go to the experiential aspect. And where the male becomes very dominant, we have a dogmatic formal aspect, formulating aspect, rational aspect. These two, when they cut the other off, become respectively the male, dry, intellectual, and the female, just rapturous and all gone, way out. But the combination of the two, as Nietzsche points out, is actually the generative principle of the arts. Here we have from Syria, from the same date, another of these goddesses, again associated with two serpents. And here from India, from Mysore, we have the mother of the serpents. This is a motif that runs through all the great Bronze Age mythologies, which are at the background of all of the later patriarchal systems, of which the biblical is one. Now we go back to Crete. The goddess not only gives birth, but she destroys, she kills. And here she stands with the two axes, the so-called labrys, the axe of the sacrifice. And now the animal that is typically the animal of the sacrifice is the bull. The horns of the bull are associated mythologically with the horns of the moon. And since the moon, with its horns, is that celestial sign which dies, the bull, with its horns, is the sacrificial animal par excellence. And then the young calf becomes the next moon to be sacrificed. But as Frazer has pointed out in The Golden Bough, and he has pointed it out, and I think successfully, at a very early period in the development of these mythologies, the principal sacrifice was not an animal, but the king. Here is a young Greek Cretan king from the Knossos mural. The king in Crete possibly was sacrificed every 8 years in relation to the cycle of the planet Venus. That is a strong possibility. At any rate, we never see pictures of old Cretan kings. And now here she is, the great goddess, standing on her mountain. The idea of the world in those ancient times, in the Bronze Age, was not of a flat platter, but of a mountain, as represented in the ziggurats, for example, or Mount Olympus. And here is the goddess of the mountain. The consort of Shiva in India is named Parvati, and that means daughter of the mountain king. Here she stands on the summit of the mountain. The stages of the heavens are on the way up. There is her animal, the lion, flanking her. And over on our left are the horns of consecration of the altar. And the second range there, you have a kind of trident motif. And now we come to a basic point, not only in mythology, but also in Jungian psychology, the center, uniting the pairs of opposites, the two horns of the bull and the center. Very often in the bull's horns we see a symbolic figure between the horns. So there's the whole story right there. Here is the goddess in India. This is Indrani at Ellora, associated with the lion. Here in the 7th century in South East India, at Mamallapuram, we have her riding on her animal, the lion, about to slay the buffalo demon with the lunar horns. And here, finally, is an Indian figure showing the whole universe as a goddess. The whole universe is the mother universe within whose womb we dwell. Now, our dwelling place is at the center there, where you see those circles at about the level of the navel. Those are to be thought of as a flat plane on which we live. The heavens are upward through the stages there to the crown of her head, and the purgatories downward to the sole of her feet. Now, what is it that leads one upward, elevates one upward into the heavens. It is the opening of the ego so that it does not put itself, it does not think of itself as the center. Opening the ego to a transpersonal force, the grace of the divine cosmic influence, is what elevates one to heaven. Until finally one is capable of beholding the bad vision, the radiant sign of the totality of the Lord of whom the universe is a manifestation. And then opposite to that, the tightening and hardening of the ego position pulls one down into the purgatories and hells of sheer madness. Now this, to me, is one of the most beautiful Greek figures I know. It's from a red figured vase from the 5th century. And what it shows quite clearly is a woman initiating a young man. This becomes particularly interesting when we see who these two people are. The name right by his sword there is Peleus, and the name here is Thetis. Those are the father and mother of Achilles. Now, in the masculine-oriented patriarchal literature of the Athenian tradition, the story of these two people tells of the woman as a goddess of the sea, who is condemned to marry a human being. And when he attempts to take her, she transforms herself into serpents and lions and so forth, but he finally masters her. That's not what we see here at all. This comes from the ceramic tradition, land-based, far more primitive in its source, going back to the Cretan times, and the woman is clearly the initiator. Furthermore, we see her associated with the serpent and the lion, and we know that these are her symbols from way back. Now let's see what's happening to the young man. He is being bitten by the serpent right here in the third eye, opening the eye of inner vision. He is being bitten by the second serpent under the ear, opening the ear to the music of the spheres, the song of the universe, and of the muses. He is being bitten on the Achilles heel, the bite of death. Now let me say that this is the principal motif of all forever histories. When you have access in death, when you are no longer holding on in all of your thinking to your ego and its continuation in the field of time and space, the world sings a new song. You go out and perfectly natural in the field of time and space to be protecting your ego and your life. But you make that the total concern so that the whole thought of death is more than you can absorb. You are not hearing the song of life, which is the song of death. There is a wonderful verse from the Taittiriya Upanishad in India. Oh wonderful, oh wonderful, oh wonderful. I am food. I am food. I am food. I am a food eater. I am a food eater. I am a food eater. One who knows this shines with a certain light. But as long as you are hanging on to the food which you are, trying to immortalize that, and not realizing that what your immortality is something far more fluid, something far more basic and transcendent than this little flicker of a lifetime, you are not hearing the song of the universe, you're hearing only the song of ego. And so this bite on the heel, and that's something wonderful. Do you see his hands? Do you see that way in which they are clasping each other in a kind of yin-yang sign? The pairs of opposites interacting, not life, death, good, evil. Remember, it was the knowledge of good and evil that threw Adam and Eve out of the garden. And before that, they did not distinguish between good and evil. And then Jesus, in one of his sayings, declares Judge not that you may not be judged, but be as your Father in heaven, whose reign falls upon the just and the unjust. And yet we think the basic religious attitude is that of condemning what we regard as the unjust. This is a superficial, what might be called ethical religiosity, the metaphysical, mystical, goes past that. Heraclitus says, for the gods, there is no difference between good and evil, but for men, there is. And so that is the initiation beyond the bite of death that he is experiencing. And when you recognize that the border of the design carries the same motif, a motif which we all recognize, you see something about the mystery of pre-existence. Here's another pair of hands like that, exactly the same way. And these are the hands of a sea deity, Achilles, who is being wrestled with by Heracles. There they are, for the possession of Deianira, who became Heracles' wife. But you see, the point of view is that of the women. We have the dance of the nymphs round about. And whereas the male will take it to be very important whether this or that wins, from this standpoint, Earth's mother, who gives and takes back, the pair of opposites interplay, and it's the interplay that really counts. To the male, on the other hand, this is a disastrous thing. Look what's happened to that young man. He's dying. This is the tragic mask. And here's the way the female looks from that point of view. This is Medusa, the head of which turns men to stone. So what do? We kill her. Put down Mother Nature. Curse the serpent. Here is Perseus fleeing with the head of Medusa in his wallet. Why is he running so fast? He's being pursued by one of her sisters. And here is Actaeon. Poor young man, he was just a hunter, followed a stream up to its source in search of a stag. And at the source, he beholds the goddess Artemis, naked, bathing with her nymphs, and regarding her, not with the eyes of one worshiping a goddess, but of one lusting for a woman. She tossed some water on his face, transformed him into a stag, which is what he was in the first place, and he was consumed by his hounds. By Dali, 1927 or so. Dream, 1/2 second before waking, inspired by the buzz of a bee around the pomegranate. The pomegranate is the fruit of the underworld. The underworld is the realm of the unconscious. The fish, which is the first manifestation out of the pomegranate, is the animal that Noah didn't have to take into the ark. It can swim in the abyssal waters and represents the power of the abyssal waters into which all dissolves, the symbolic of the unconscious. Then we see the tiger power pouncing out. And above an elephant is a kind of a phallic motif there, and the woman in terror. Here is another Dali picture called Persistence of Memory, or Wet Watches. The point here is that in the unconscious system, there is no notion of the passage of the time of our life. That's to say, even in very late life, you can experience an emotion that stems from archetypes that were established in your infancy. The problem, then, of life is not to suppress those emotions, to suppress those feelings, but to bring them into your life in terms that are in accord with the date, with the time, with the age of your life. as the art of life. Not suppressing, but integrating in the field of consciousness these unconscious systems. When the unconscious pours in, you get this kind of a stress. And you don't know what's plus or minus, up or down, male or female. The characteristic of the elements in the unconscious is that they contaminate each other. And they all come up of a lump. Dolly called this premonitions of civil war, or soft composition of oil beans. And now I'm trying to explain what happened here. The ego has lost its sense of security. You can see this happen in colleges all the time. A student comes, let's say, from this environment, and another student from a contrasting environment, an environment which the parents of student A would regard as not quite nice. And then the two students are roommates, and A finds that B is quite nice, and that the things that B does, which A was taught not to do, are interesting, if nothing else. And there comes a uncertainty, a sense of uncertainty about one's moral values. The persona begins to disintegrate. And when that happens, two results from the unconscious. One, the shadow power threatens to come up. Who dare? And one is terrified of it, pushes it down. The other, there comes an exotic allure, the anima or animus of quite different kinds from those that the family has suggested begin to be interesting. And so there's this double pull. This is what I say at the beginning of that interesting life. No longer secure. Meanwhile, the poor ego is trying to hang on to his persona ideals with more and more strength, so that there comes almost a sterilization of life. One is pulled in this direction with one set of energies, another set of energies, one's trying to keep oneself from going in that direction, so where is the energy for life?